Okay, hopefully we have everybody. Ms. Brownsy? Ms. Brownsy?
Yes.
Mr. Berry?
Yes.
And Ms. Heather Berry?
Yes.
Yes, you got them.
Thank you, Barbara. You could just hold on, and the hearing will start very shortly. The Honorable Mr. Kalanis will be chairing this hearing, so just hold on.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. Mr. Jackson, can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir.
I think you have one of those phone receivers that's very sensitive, so we can hear your breathing very hard. It's just the phone, it's not you. So just if you can hold it down in between having a discussion with us, it'll help us control some of the background sound.
Yes, sir.
I'll begin the hearing now. Can you state your full name and ABC number for the record?
Levi Jackson, 13112.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for 31412B parole hearing to consider parole to your next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. I would like to introduce you to the members of the board conducting the hearing with you today. Today we're authorized for a three-member panel, and on the bench we have the Honorable Mr. David Neal. At the center of the bench we have our esteemed board chairman, Dr. C.T. Wright. My name is Louis Quinones. I'll be serving as the panel chairman for this hearing. I'll begin the hearing with a summary. Mr. Levi Jackson is 41 years old. He was certified eligible by ADC for 31412B parole to his next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. He's currently serving life imprisonment for first-degree murder, a repetitive offense. He is pending two consecutive 21-year sentences for armed robbery and kidnapping. Does this sound correct so far, Mr. Jackson?
Yes, sir.
Said crimes occurred on or about December 7th, 1992. He was approximately 16 years old at the time of the incident offense. He was convicted by jury trial, and on September 27th, 1993, and sentenced to death, at least initially. On June 4th, 2005, his death sentence was vacated, lowering his sentence from death to life with the possibility of parole. Although Mr. Jackson had a criminal history limited to the juvenile justice system, the incident offense did represent a steady escalation in violence. According to ADC time computation, he is parole eligible effective March 10, 2018. I will now read a summary of the offense in question. At approximately 1:30 p.m. on December 7th, 1992, Mr. Jackson and co-defendant waited for a car to stop near the area of 24th Street and Columbus Avenue, Tucson, when the 40-year-old female victim approached in her vehicle and stopped. One or all of the defendants asked her for a light for a cigarette. She reached for the cigarette lighter in the car, and one of the defendants pointed the stolen 45 caliber handgun at her head and told her to move over, which she did. The defendants took control of the car, kept the gun pointed at her, and drove her to a desert area where she was shot once in the chest. The bullet passed through her left forearm before entering her chest. She died from this gunshot wound, which lacerated her heart and left lung. The defendants then departed in her car. Mr. Jackson has completed moderate programming in ADC. This is a hearing to consider parole to his next sentence, but he has a plan to live and work with his parents. He has a history of discipline in ADC from 1994 to 2015, with his last major on September 10, 2015, for refusing to program. This is his first hearing before the board. He has letters of support in his parole packet. There are also several victims participating in this hearing by telephone who oppose this parole. So, Mr. Jackson, this is an opportunity for the board to get to know you. I will just do a brief check here to make sure that I'm correct in stating so. But if I am not mistaken, This is your first time before the board. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Again, this is a chance for you to get to know you. So can you tell us in your own words about the crimes, or pardon me, the crime that led to your incarceration?
There's not much I really can tell in one regard. I was a stupid ass kid who got caught up and didn't do anything to show anybody any reason to care one way or the other. Miss Bowen lost her life. I destroyed families. And I didn't show anybody that I gave a damn. I acted. I didn't care. I didn't care about what happened. I could argue facts and figures and who did what and specifics, but it doesn't matter. You didn't do anything to stop what happened. And the only thing that, I guess in some ways that I wish I had really realized back then is how much damage I had done, and I couldn't. And it took a long time before I actually did. And then when I did, I was stuck and there was nothing I could do or say about it. And how can I expect anybody to give a damn when I never did? So, as far as the crime goes, I mean, I can't give you any excuses. There are none. I could give excuses, but they would be wrong. The truth is, you didn't care. You didn't do anything after the fact. You didn't do anything when it happened. You didn't do a damn thing. When you went down, you thought, I'm a man, I'm cool, I'm tough, what do I care? When they put you in, when they tried you, you didn't do anything. You glared at people, you flipped people off, you acted like a jackass. And I don't know what to say or do to show anybody that I screwed up and I want to try to make it right, and I don't know how. And I don't know what I'm supposed to say or what I'm supposed to do, because I don't know. I'm now doing the best I can. I can't make any excuses for the way I behaved when I came to prison. I wanted to be a badass, so I did what I thought I had to do to survive. I was 18. Prison, you have two choices. You either get eaten or you eat. I did what I felt I had to do to survive so that I wouldn't be eaten. And then as I got older and I started to realize my behavior and what I had done and how much impact that it had, I started to change. And yes, my last offense was, there's a lot more behind that story as opposed to the ticket of refusal of the program. That's not actually what went on, but that's a DOC issue and it really doesn't affect anything. Overall, in my opinion, my tickets have gotten less and I've been behaving myself. I have two associate's degrees, I've earned an EPA card. I've done what I can do within the limits of what DOC allows me to try and show that I've grown. And I don't really know what else I'm supposed to do or what I can do or what I can say or how to get somebody to go, oh, okay, you know what? You screwed it. It doesn't fix anything. I'm sorry. I can't fix it. I can't change it. I can't go back and correct anything. I'm sorry. I'm just sorry. And I wish I had said that so many years ago. And people look at things, sometimes they think, well, you know, oh, you're sorry because you're trying to get out. No, I'm not getting out. I'm not doing anything except going to my next number. I'm saying I'm sorry because I never did. I never got to say I screwed up. And I'm sorry for what I did to everybody. I guess that's what I'm supposed to say. I was a stupid-ass kid. I'm sorry. I grew up in a warm environment. It's not anybody's fault. There's no excuses. It's not my parents' fault. It's not anybody's fault. It's my fault. And I'm just sorry to everybody. To you guys for having to do this, for the victims' family, for having to come to every single one of these that I get, for them coming to this day, every time there was an appeal, to every time there was anything, I'm just sorry for everything I did. I'm sorry that I never told anybody. I'm sorry that I didn't stand up and say something so that at least they would know what happened instead of what everybody else has told them. And I never said or did anything. And I'm sorry. And I don't know what else I'm supposed to say. I'm sorry.
Mr. Jackson, first of all, thank you for being honest with the board or candid. And I recognize... this is the first time you've been before the board. I know you've stated several times about what you're supposed to say. I don't think it's a question of what you're supposed to say to the board. We're looking for you to be honest, to account for yourself, and allow us to make an informed decision. So I will ask again, I appreciate that you stated that you're trying not to make excuses, but in your words, what happened? What happened, like, where were you at that time? Who were you with? What happened, sir?
Okay, I understand. You want me to go over the occurrences of that day?
Yes.
Am I understanding that correctly? Okay.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I was ditching. I went to school, I ditched school. Kevin's girlfriend told me that Kevin was looking for me. That's one of my co-defendants. I went to the apartment where Kevin, she said Kevin was at, I don't remember the name of it. Picked my room out, he said he had to go file the things you put in for work when you're trying to get a job, applications. And I was telling him we need some money, he was saying we need money. We saw Ray, looked at Ray, and I said, hold on, I know this dude, I don't really like him, but I go talk to him. And I talked to Ray, I said, you know, hey, trying to figure out what to do to get some money. He goes, I know where there's a gun. I said, okay, let's go get a gun, we'll rob a bank. Not a justification, but in my mind, I wanted to rob a bank. Ray takes us to this house, he goes, hey, doors are locked. Here, this window's open, I know this house, this window's always open. He jumps in the window, he pops open the back door, there's a dog, he says, I'll hold up the dog, the gun's right there, grab it. I reached in, I grabbed the gun, we took off. I remember being in an alley, we're all looking at the gun, we're looking at the bullets, it's loaded, and then we're standing across from a Dairy Queen, and I said, we should rob the Dairy Queen, and Kevin goes, no, let's get this car right here. And I said, for what? He says, we can rob a bank. I go, yeah, let's do that. And then the car drove away, this was some other car. So we were wandering. There's a statement that we talked to some people in the apartment. I honestly do not recall ever talking to anybody in an apartment. So my brain's blank there. I remember standing at the corner trying to figure out what to do. I went to a bank. I said, well, I'm blank. We need a car. We're going to have to get a car. This car pulls up. I said, here, let's get this car. I walked over. I put the gun in the window. I told Miss Bowen to scoot over. Excuse me. I asked her for a light and I didn't smoke. She reached for the lighter. I told her to scoot over. She scoots over. I hopped in the back seat because I don't know how to drive. Kevin jumps in the front. Ray was next to me. We drove off to the middle of nowhere. I don't remember most of the drive. I remember one point we almost drove onto the Davis-Monthan Air Force Base. And then it's a large blank spot. Like, I really don't remember. I remember getting to the desert. I remember we turned the car around. I remember Kevin got out, and the question was, what do we do now? And he walked back, he got her shoes and her jacket, threw them in the door, came up to us and said, what are we going to do now? I started digging through the bush and said, hell, I don't know. I didn't care. It didn't even register in my head what we were doing. I reached over and I started digging through the purse. I heard boom, bang, pow, a sound. It was a gunshot. I kind of glanced over my shoulder and gave it no more thought than that. I didn't even care. He jumped in. I said, is she dead? He goes, yeah. Steps on the gas. We took off. I'm digging through the purse. I find a forearm. And I see kids, and I said, hey, man, she had kids, dude. And I remember Ray kind of looked around, said, let me see that. And I handed it to him. And then he said, is there a PIN number? And I said, I don't know. And I went back to digging the purse. That is almost literally the amount of thought that I gave to what had happened. I didn't care. I never once said we shouldn't do this. There were things in the trial about a long discussion, and none of that ever occurred. And I've been mad about the fact that everybody has had the wrong impression of what went down. I am no way excusing my behavior. I didn't care. It just didn't matter. It just didn't register. I didn't care. I remember when he walked up and leaned his arm to the window. He said, so what do we do now? And I remember I kind of shrugged, like, whatever. And I went back to digging in the purse, looking for the PIN number to do how to use the credit cards. And Miss Bowerman was gone, and there was, I didn't think about it. Do you need me to continue until I was arrested, or is that what you
want? I think that was probably a good summary. I'll ask you, this is your hearing, but what happened in the criminal justice system with your co-defendants?
Ray Allen Hernandez was told that if he didn't testify against me, he was going to be given the death penalty. He then agreed to testify against me. Kevin Miles pretty much told on himself. Was caught with the car, with the victim's shoes, her jacket, a high-speed chase, all of her credit cards, and was arrested in Phoenix and was sentenced to death.
Okay, so you...
Ray Hernandez has gotten out since then.
You've been in the correction system since 1992 or 93. How have you changed since you've been inside the DOC in this time, sir?
Well, okay. One, I don't do drugs. I smoked my last joint in 09. I never tried the other drug, didn't want to, had no interest in it. I don't drink. Have no interest in it, don't want to. I maintain my health. I have completed what programs I could over the last 5 or 6 years. I'd say I don't associate with gang members, but this is prison, it's kind of impossible not to. So I don't get involved in any of their garbage. This, I don't know if that makes any sense. I don't much care what they do. I have obtained 2 associate's degrees. I have obtained a universal certification for an EPA card. I have completed project management. I took an anger management class that was taught by an inmate. Really wasn't teaching me anything, so instead I just went and kind of did it on my own because I felt that was more important. My whole way of thinking about things has changed. 6, 7 years ago, a woman that I was with told me, she said, you won't get out because you don't deserve it. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, your thinking is wrong. You're not thinking right. I'm paraphrasing, but what she was trying to express to me was, you're too negative. You're always looking at negative, and you're always looking at you're looking at things from the wrong angle. And I started to see that I needed to be more positive. I focused on my artwork. I focused on my writing. I stopped focusing on prison and gangs and what's in prison and using people. There you go. There's what we're looking for. I stopped trying to think of how to use people. I used to look at people as they're either a tool or they're just a waste of space. And I stopped doing that. I try to look at people as people. I try to understand why people think the way they do or how they do things so that I can understand how to interact with them. I'm not the greatest interact. I'm not a social butterfly, but I try to interact with people. I try not to get upset or be mad about things or have angry reactions to stuff. Whereas before, if you did anything I didn't like, well, I was just going to beat you up. So in a lot of ways, that's kind of how I've changed my way of thinking, my way of looking at things, is trying to see people as people, trying to understand what you did to put you here, trying to better yourself mentally. It's a hard thing to express. One thing could be to look at, as somebody explained to me, they said to look at how you don't even get tickets like you used to anymore. You don't screw up all the time. You mind your own business. You don't get involved in all the garbage. You don't drink. You don't smoke. You don't do anything. And I said, that's because I don't want to be involved in any of that. And I asked somebody, I said, how do I express that to a friend? And they said, you really can't. You just have to hope that they can see it. And I mean, if there's something else, ask, and I'll do my best to answer you.
So in the...
Excuse me, my nose was running.
I understand that it's apparent there's a lot of cold and flu going around right now.
I'm sorry, it was from... I'm feeling good. It was the emotions.
Sir, according to the original reports, you were the individual who shot the victim, and are you saying that that's not what happened?
Yeah, correct.
I recognize this is your first time before the board. I'm going to ask the fellow board members if they have any questions for you at this point. Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman.
So when did you change, sir? You, if I heard you correct, you were real bad, one of the worst people on the planet, so to speak, and now you're saying that you're a changed person. What point did you change? 10 years ago, 20 years ago, anything happened for you to change to become a better person, sir?
It was probably, probably 7 or 8 years ago. Somewhere between 10 and 7 years. Let's go with that. That sounds a lot better. Part of it was the lady that I was with and her constant trying to change me, trying to get me to see things better. Another thing was when I got jumped. I got jumped by 3 individuals, and after that happened, I was kind of like, what have I been doing? Those are kind of what made me start to sit there and go, hey, wait a minute, hold on. And it didn't happen overnight. It was a progressive thing. Like, I started to see it, and then I started to enact it. And the thing that I kept telling myself is, look, you might get out of here. If that is to happen, you cannot think this way in society. These people in society don't survive. They come to prison. Okay, what you did survived in prison. That's fine. That was a mentality that was necessary. But what if they turn around tomorrow and they say, go home? Because there was a bunch of stuff going on regarding juveniles and stuff like that. And that's what I would, you need to change your way of thinking. And that's where it started. So.
Okay, so a couple of 3 times or more, you mentioned that lady. Do you still have a relationship with that lady? You never mentioned, you just said that lady. So that's the reason I'm saying that lady.
No, sir,
that's
what you said, sir. Pardon me?
I said, you refer to her as that lady, and I said, that's why I'm referring to her as that lady.
Her name is Lori.
Yes, sir.
No, in 2012, she was getting older, and we had a discussion, and I remember after our talk, I went home, and I was sitting in my cell at the time, and I thought, I have to do what's right by her and let her go live and have a life and a relationship and boyfriend and a life out there, because it's wrong to keep her attached to me, stuck in here. I have to do this, not her. And she's been with me. She at the time had been with me for 6 years. Lori had been with me for 6 years. And it was wrong. to say the 100,000 different things I could have said that would have kept her around. It was better to tell her as we did on the, go live your life, go have your relationship, and go be happy. Because being with me ain't gonna do that, because I'm stuck in here. That's, I think that's what you're asking for.
Yeah, so now, you've kind of made a contradictory statement, so I want to see which one is true. Or maybe I didn't hear you correct. At one point you said that, I interpreted what you said, was that you would never get out of prison, and then I've heard you say since then that if or when you get out, so which it is, do you plan to stay in prison the rest of your life, or do you plan to get out? What, I mean, in your mind, not nobody else's, not the prison officials, not this board, but in your mind, what do you think the future holds for you?
I believe that, how do I put this so it makes sense? I'm stuck with 42 more years to do, at least. But I believe that with a lot of what's going on in the political system regarding juveniles and how people are starting to look at locking juveniles up for these, what in my case amounts to 67 to life, isn't necessarily appropriate. So what I'm, any day the court could come down and say, you know what, you can't keep giving these kids these ungodly sentences. And if that is to happen, you have to make, you're not going to have 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years to get yourself ready to get out. They could turn on the court rule. I mean, there's nothing, the two appeals that were in front of the court, from my understanding, have been shot down, but that doesn't mean something else won't come up. And at any time that can come up, and then your sentence changes, and now you're going home, what are you going to do? It's too late then, so you have to make that change now. So it's kind of like a little of both, I guess. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. It makes sense.
I need to be contradictory. I apologize.
No, I was just asking because it, that's just the way it sounds. Now, if it were today, you're here to for the board to make a determination whether to parole you to your next consecutive sentence. But if someday you were to get out, how would you react, sir? You've been incarcerated all these years. Would you be able to adjust to the world as it is, or would you still be that bad person that existed when you went in, sir?
Well, the obvious, easiest answer is to say no, but the truth is, no, I wouldn't be, because of the mental changes that I have already made within myself. So no, the simple answer is no, I wouldn't be that same person. That same person, to quote kind of a phrase, I don't remember where it came from, and I'm probably not getting it right, but the Obi is dead, I'm kind of glad that he died, and I hope he stays there. The Obi is gone, and I don't want him around. I don't like who that person was, I didn't like having to be that person, and that's not who I am. So if I were to get out, the first, well, I mean, after I went home and said hi to my folks, honestly, it would probably take a week to kind of get up to gear, but the first thing I'm going to do is go out and get a job. And I've told people, I said, I don't care if they let me lick floors at McDonald's. I'll lick floors at McDonald's. I don't care. I'm out. I'm free. I'm not in prison. Now it's time to step up and show how you've changed. I see, like hoping that I'll have enough money where I can just go and buy like a bunch of school supplies and give them to a school teacher so they can help kids. I see things like that on TV, and I'm always like, well, how can I do something? And I mean, here I really can. But the hope, if I were to get out, is that I could go and help out a teacher at school, or I could help out somebody, anybody, anything. I don't know. Anything along those lines. It's hard to quantify how you would help exactly when you don't. You can't see it because you were never there. All I know is that the way I feel, the way I think, and the way I've changed, I know that if that opportunity were to present itself, I would take full advantage of it and make the most of it. I've got my artwork that I would try to push, that I would be at art shows with all the time. I can write. You can do that from home. When I write, I can sit down and do those things. Any job at all, anything.
Okay, sir. Thank you so very much, and I don't have any further questions at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. Mr. Neal? Okay, Mr. Jackson, we have both supporters and victims' representatives, and I will begin with your supporters. Before people come to the podium to address the board, I will ask that you be concise. I think we have quite a few people who want to speak, so please be thoughtful about the time. But who would like to speak first on behalf of Mr. Jackson? Thank you, ma'am. Would you like to approach the podium? Good afternoon, ma'am. And can you state your name for the record?
Okay. Carol Korich, K-O-R-I-C-H.
Thank you, ma'am.
Board members. I've known Levi Jackson for 26 years. He has become my unofficial grandson. I have written a letter to the board, so I won't take too much of your time. Due to recent research, we know that the frontal lobes of the human brain, where decisions are made, do not completely develop until approximately 23, 25 in that area. When Levi was 16, he was very confused about where he fit in his family and in his community. He was very susceptible to peer pressure. He gave into that peer pressure, and the very worst happened. After turning himself in, he has been in the custody of juvenile detention, the county jail, and the Department of Corrections. Can you imagine how difficult it is to grow up under those conditions? By the age of 25, the age when his brain was probably fully developed, he had been locked up for 9 years. I have watched Levi gradually overcome all of that. It took some time, but I watched as his decisions began to become more mature. I watched as his concern for others around him, including fellow inmates, developed. I watched as he began to care about his future, as he learned that education was very important and that he could do well in that area. I believe that he is truly remorseful for his crime. I am very proud of the man Levi has become. It's time for him to re-enter the outside world with the support of all of us who love him. I'm certain that he can become a positive member of society. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions from fellow board members? Thank you for your time, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Please approach the podium. If you can state your name.
Corey Jackson.
And what would you like to share with the board, ma'am?
I'm Levi's mom. I wrote a letter to you. His father and his stepmom and his sister would like to be, but they are sick. He has family support and hope. We're waiting for him. I've seen him grow and mature, and it's been beautiful, especially in the last several years. And I know what he was talking about because I've done a lot of that work on my own. Please let him come home.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions from fellow board members? Thank you, ma'am. Thank you for your time. Is there anyone else that would like to speak on behalf of Mr. Jackson?
Excuse me, the people on the call cannot hear what's going on.
Okay, ma'am, we're doing the best we can. Sometimes the PA system inside the hearing room isn't always clear. Can you hear me clearly? Can you hear me clearly? Ma'am?
No, we can't hear you.
You're saying we. Aren't you just one individual that's on the telephone right now?
We can barely hear you, but it's very faint. It's not as loud as the beginning part of the hearing.
How about now? Well, I'm speaking directly into the microphone. Can you hear me? It's going to be almost too loud inside the hearing room, but I'm going to turn up our microphone and see if we can remain clear for you, okay?
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you, ma'am. I will ask again, are there any other individuals in the hearing room who want to speak on behalf of Mr. Jackson? Okay, I will now, I'm going to go in an order. I'm going to ask the individuals on the telephone, and I will call you by name. If you would like to share anything with the board, and I will begin with Ms. Mildred Brownsey. Ms. Brownsey, can you state your full name? Ms. Brownsey?
Can you give her a minute? She needs to unmute her phone.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm very sorry, but my name is Mildred Brownsey, and I am the mother of Patricia Bowerman, who was murdered by Levi Jackson on December 7th, 1992.
Thank you, ma'am. And again, thank you for stating your name. Is there anything else you would like to share with the board?
I am 89 years old. My health is declining. And I was hoping that this would all be over with long time ago, but it seems to be dragging on for many, many years. Patricia left two boys, and our family supports them. I am in Tampa supporting her youngest son, who is graduating Friday from law enforcement school, and he's grew up to be a very fine young man. We all miss Patty very much, and we feel that Mr. Jackson's horrible actions, that he should stay in the prison, and he should be there the rest of his life. As he took her life, and we cannot participate in her life anymore. I believe that's my conclusion.
Thank you, ma'am, and that's very good to hear that some of your from your family has joined the law enforcement community. Did you say that some of your family just completed the academy?
Yes.
Well, congratulations on that. Is there anything else you would like to share with the board?
We miss her very much on a daily basis.
Thank you very much, ma'am. And thank you for appearing before the board today by telephone. I'm going to move the questions for the victim's representative to Mr. Timothy Berry. Mr. Berry, are you still on the phone? Mr. Berry? Mr. Timothy Berry, are you still on the phone? I will ask, do you have your mute button on right now? Because if so, we can't hear you. I will try that again in just a moment. Is there a Ms. Heather Berry that's on the telephone right now?
Yes, that is me.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Berry.
On behalf of my father, Tim Berry, I think he sent in his victim impact statement to the victim services, and I would appreciate it if they would read his statement for him.
Hold on one second. I'm going to ask a question of one of our victim coordinators.
We do not have a statement from Timothy Berry.
Okay, we don't have a statement from Mr. Berry, ma'am. And if I'm not mistaken, the victims coordinators would be all too glad to read the statement, but it's not available. Is there anything else that you would like to share?
I would like to share my own victim impact statement, but can you give me just a moment while
yes,
I'm on the cell phone?
Absolutely.
Okay, just one moment.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Bilby. Are there any other statements you would like to share near the end?
I had a statement from Mildred Brownsey, who spoke.
Okay.
I had a statement from Heather Patricia Berry, who's going to speak now.
Okay.
And I won't review their statements, but I do have one from Virginia Berry.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, so you could just read my statement for me?
Yes, the victim's coordinator can read the statement in the hearing room if you'd like, ma'am.
Yes, please.
Okay, okay, Mr. Belby, pardon me, Mr. Belby, you can approach the podium.
Good afternoon, members of the board. My name is Brian Bilby. I'm a victim advocate with the Arizona Department of Corrections. I'm going to read a statement from Heather Patricia Berry, Levi Jackson. Levi Jackson is a monster and has shown no remorse for his crime. Levi Jackson will never be a productive member of society, and he has shown he will never be given the opportunity to build a life of his own outside of prison walls. He and his family should have to suffer the same pain and anguish that my family has suffered by not being able to have our family member present at all of our life's milestones, like weddings, graduations, and other important events. My family has been sentenced to living a life without Patty. This justice system has slapped my family in the face by overturning Mr. Jackson's death penalty sentence. Please do not slap us in the face again by granting parole to a monster who deserved to die. My family will fight until the day we die to keep him behind bars. Heather Patricia Berry.
Thank you, sir.
And if it pleases the board, I have another letter from Virginia Berry.
Yes, for the sake of clarity, it's probably good to read it again. It's a different one, pardon me. I thought it was one of the original statements. Thank you.
This is from Virginia Berry. She is not sorry for him being in prison or the fact that he threw his whole life away. She's very glad that he's in prison. Even though her sister-in-law was taken from her, sister-in-law Patricia was taken from her, her sons are thriving, and she's happy that he remains in prison. She's very disappointed. She can't believe that the inmate has taken everything away from himself at such an early age, and that he put his family through this tragedy. She doesn't pray for him. The Lord knows what he did. And she hopes that the parole board will make a good decision on leaving him in prison for the remainder of his life that he has left in the same. Virginia Berry, and I worded it the way I did because the statement is really directed towards the inmate long custody.
Thank you, Mr. Bilby.
Thank you.
Okay, I believe at this point we've spoken to the victim's representatives that are on the telephone. We've heard from the inmate supporters. I think at this point we'll open the podium to Mr. Unclesby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, board members, my name is Rick Unclesby. I'm with the Pima County Attorney's Office. I've got a bit of a cough, so I apologize in advance if I sound a little rough. While we all appreciate the fact that inmates improve themselves while they're incarcerated, there are some crimes for which forgiveness cannot be given. Mr. Jackson said today about the facts of the case in which he said that he was not the shooter and that his guilt was in not preventing the action from happening. I'd like to read three or four brief passages from the Supreme Court opinion on Mr. Jackson's case with regards to the Supreme Court's findings of the facts of Ms. Valerie's murder. Mr. Chairman, as you stated earlier, December 7th, 1992, Patricia Bowerman was driving out of a parking area onto Columbus in Tucson. Supreme Court's opinion states that Jackson, Kevin Miles, and Ray Hernandez were standing near the stop sign. Jackson approached her car, asked her for a light. As she looked away, Jackson pulled out a gun, pointed it at her, and ordered her to scoot over. Jackson, Miles, and Hernandez then got into the car. Jackson drove into the desert area in the southeast side of Tucson, When they stopped, Jackson ordered the victim away from the car. Several minutes later, Jackson shot her. She died from a gunshot wound to the chest. The Supreme Court went on and upholding what was then a death sentence against this inmate in finding that the aggravating factors to support the death penalty had been proven. The Supreme Court stated, the state has proven that the victim was helpless. She was unarmed, she had no shoes or jacket. She was outnumbered 3-1 and did not resist. The evidence showed that the bullet first passed through her forearm and it pierced her heart. This is consistent with the finding that she had her hands up in a defensive position before she was shot. Finally, the state proved that Jackson relished the murder. Immediately after the murder, he began to sing a rap song. Later, Miles showed Jackson a picture he had found in her purse of the victim's children. Jackson again began to sing a rap song. On the drive back to Tucson, Jackson, on two separate occasions, expressed his desire to repeat the experience. They first came across a bicyclist, and Jackson said, quote, "Let's jack this guy right here," unquote. Miles and Hernandez did not want to. Sometime later, they passed a woman jogging. Jackson said, quote, "Let's jack her too." Again, Miles and Hernandez chose not to. Supreme Court went on to hold that on the morning of the murder, Jackson met with Hernandez and asked him where he could obtain a gun to commit a robbery. Jackson and Miles then accompanied Hernandez to a home where Jackson broke in and stole the gun. On the way back from the home, Hernandez suggested that they rob a nearby Dairy Queen. Jackson declined. Instead, as the car approached, Jackson said, "Watch me, quote, watch me jack this bitch," unquote, and attempted to carjack the driver. That driver, however, quickly sped off before Jackson could reach her. Thwarted in his first carjacking attempt, Jackson fell out the ruse. As the victim's car approached, he asked her for a light. He then pointed the gun at her and took over. He drove the car approximately 30 minutes to a remote desert area, unaffected by the victim's pleas for mercy. He did not kill her immediately. Instead, he pondered his victim's fate while she begged for her life. Jackson's crime does not show juvenile impulsivity. He planned it, made all the necessary preparatory steps, and carried it out. Instead of robbing the victim at the point of abduction, which might reflect the impulsive act of a young, inexperienced, and immature person, Jackson drove her to a remote desert area to accomplish his crimes. He displayed deliberateness and an ability to delay gratification. In a concurring opinion, Justice Feldman wrote, "The facts of this case are so egregious and the crime so shockingly evil that to hold the defendant's age alone outweighs the aggravating circumstances is to say that we will never impose the death penalty on a 16-year-old." And the Supreme Court upheld his death sentence. I was not the original prosecutor on the case. One of my colleagues was that has passed away, but I conducted the 2005 resentencing. The reason there was a resentencing is I'm sure the board knows that the United States Supreme Court in 2004 decided that those who committed their crime under the age of 18 could not be subjected to the death penalty. Mr. Jackson was resentenced in 2005 to 25 years to life, as natural life did not become an available option until 1994. So Mr. Jackson received the lowest sentence, or the only other sentence that he could receive upon resentencing in 2005. The resentencing court left in place his consecutive sentences. As I said at the beginning, we all appreciate the fact that it is difficult for inmates to do well in prison. I hope Mr. Jackson has done well. I hope the things that he's telling the board today are true, that he is truly remorseful. Nonetheless, as Justice Feldman said in his concurring opinion, this was a crime that was shockingly evil. It was egregious in the way that Mr. Jackson committed this crime. He sets before you today denying that he was the person who pulled the trigger, but the facts at trial belie that. The facts at trial showed that he was the person who put the gun up to Ms. Byerlin as she begged for her life and shot her, even though she was unable to resist, unable to defend herself, and as the court found, holding up her hands in a defensive posture before this inmate shot her. I'm glad Mr. Jackson brought up the issue of, Dr. Wright was questioning him about his plans for the future and this consecutive 42 years that he's facing. Mr. Jackson is correct, in fact, that the U.S. Supreme Court has issued a couple of opinions in the past 5 years, the first one in 2012, the second one in 2016. These were the Miller Montgomery cases, if the board is familiar with those. What the U.S. Supreme Court has said is that courts who have sentenced juvenile offenders to natural life in prison have to determine whether or not those sentences do in fact meet the new guidelines set down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Although the U.S. Supreme Court has talked only about natural life, Mr. Jackson and a number of juveniles across the country have filed motions in an attempt to persuade sentencing courts that their sentences, in Mr. Jackson's case, of a consecutive 42 years, is what we call a de facto natural life sentence, such that he as well should benefit from the U.S. Supreme Court's decision. Mr. Jackson is currently in litigation in Pima County. He has attorneys appointed for him. They have asked the judge in Pima County until June of this year to file their petition. So while Mr. Jackson is correct in stating that that sentence, his consecutive sentence, could at some point be subject to a reduction, my office is opposing that. We do not feel that Mr. Jackson is one of those individuals who meets the criteria of the United States Supreme Court holding in the Montgomery case. In any event, I bring that up, since Mr. Jackson did, just to fully inform this board that even if you chose to parole Mr. Jackson to his consecutive sentence, there's no guarantee that consecutive sentence is going to remain in place. My position is, it will be with the trial court, that it should, because Mr. Jackson is one of those juveniles who the Supreme Court defines as a permanently incorrigible, and that his consecutive sentences should remain in place. But the board should know, specifically since he brought it up, that he is concurrently in Pima County Superior Court asking that those consecutive 21-year sentences be reduced. So I think it's fair, and I think it's important for the board to take that into consideration, that even if you do choose to parole him, there is no guarantee that he'll be in prison for the consecutive 21 on two different counts. That's subject to litigation that will take place sometime later this year once his attorneys file his motion. So that matter is in play at this point. I'm here before you today to express my office's opposition to a parole from his first-degree murder crime. It was egregious. Ms. Bowerlin was a totally innocent victim. She left behind two young boys who grew up. She was divorced. Ms. Bowerlin was divorced at the time. She was raising her two boys as a single mother. I think she was 41 at the time. And at that young age, she was taken away from her sons. I didn't know that one of the sons was now graduating from the academy. I'm glad to hear that that son is doing well. Mr. Jackson impacted a number of lives with his actions. As the court found, they were not the product of an immature juvenile mind, but they were the product of a deliberate act, a planned act on his part. And because of his actions, because of the egregious nature of his crime, I would ask the board to deny parole at this point and have him continue serving his sentence on the first-degree murder count. That's all that I had, unless the board members have any questions for me.
Thank you, Mr. Ogilvie. I just have one, and it's just for a greater understanding on an issue, because you're here, and that is, not to be tactless, but if this crime had happened after 1994, death could have been vacated to natural life?
Yes. In 1992, the state of Arizona only had two sentences for first-degree murder, the death penalty or 25 to life. It wasn't until 1994 that the legislature added natural life as an option, but that was not applicable to Mr. Jackson, even though he was sentenced in 2005, because it would be an ex post facto application to impose a natural life sentence on him. So the only option that the sentencing court had in 2005, since the death penalty had to be vacated, the only option then was the 25 to life, and the court was bound to that.
Thank you for being bringing clarity to that issue.
Certainly.
Mr. Uncles. Any further questions?
Thank you, Norman.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for making the trip to Phoenix. Mr. Jackson, we're getting close to the end of your hearing. Is there a final statement you would like to make before the board, before we go into discussion? We only ask that you don't repeat yourself or repeat anything that's already been said, but this is your hearing. So is there anything else you would like to share before we go into discussion?
I'll try to make it quick. One, I'm glad to hear that her sons have made something out of their lives. Thank God for that. Two, I understand Mr. Uncle B is a lawyer and he puts the facts as they're written. I understand that. As I stated earlier, I never said anything to contrary what was stated. The facts, however, were developed from a co-defendant who initially gave one statement, then when they told him they were going to see the death penalty, changed the statement, and then, of course, blamed me for everything. Again, my fault. I'm the one who stepped up and said nothing. I'm the one who acted the way I did. I can expect the court and nobody else to look or think any other way given the circumstances of what had happened. That is, I'm not even here to argue facts. It doesn't matter. I'm here only to say that the facts as they have them, and what has bothered me is that this Miss Bowden's family has never heard the truth, because one person was trying to cover his own ass, and the other person was doing anything he could and saying anything he could to cover his own neck. I never said anything. I'm sorry. They've had to live with this horrible reoccurrence of this. Every time there's a parole hearing, every time there's an appeal, every time there's something in the courts, every time there's anything, they have to go through this again and again. It's about me more opportunity to correct myself and become something better. It's about them never to move on with their lives, and I feel horrible for that every day. The facts are what they are, but they're inaccurate, but I know where they came from, and that's not any issue for the parole board to deal with. I'm sorry to them and everybody else who was a friend, Ms. Bowden and Ms. Patricia Bowden, everybody who was a friend, every student, every person, kids. And I'm thankful that at least your kids didn't grow up to be the disasters that I did. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. The board will be going into discussion now. It may sound like we're talking to you directly, but is the board discussing the case amongst itself before we come to our individual votes? So if you'll just remain on the phone, we'll come back to you shortly. You're reminded that we operate under the open meeting laws of Arizona. The board members do not discuss these cases before we come into the boardroom. So again, we will come back to you shortly with our decision. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
The board is now in discussion. The fellow board members, I think I'll try to keep it concise. Based on the serious nature of this heinous crime, I don't believe that paroling Mr. Jackson to his next consecutive sentence would further the interests of justice nor be consistent with the safety and welfare of the public. I do believe Mr. Jackson is developing as a person. He's on a journey. But I'll say again, as one voting board member, I don't believe, at least in this stage of his development in the correction system, that he's ready to be paroled to the next sentence. But that's where I'd like to begin the discussion.
Of course, I agree, and I think in view of the impending action, legal action, judicial action that's taking place in Pima County, I think that we would be in best not to parole to the next consecutive sentence. We recognize the importance of Mel Montgomery, but in view of where we are at this particular moment, I don't think that we should, that he's ready to be paroled to his next sentence, sir. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. Therefore, I'm going to make a motion, and that is to
denied parole to the next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. And based on the year of the crime, I'm going to ask for 1 year shut off.
Agreed.
And before we vote, I will state my reasons for denial, and we'll make sure that we get our vote in the end. And that is a serious and violent offense, loss of human life, serious and deviant offense, trauma to the victim, it goes without saying, serious bodily injury, support institutional behavior up until 2015. I'd say 2015 is a recent disciplinary infraction. And I'll ask my fellow board members if there's any other issues that you think are appropriate. Those are my reasons, and again, I am making a motion to deny parole to the next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge with a 1 year set off.
Thank you. Agree.
Okay, Mr. Jackson, the board has voted to deny parole to the next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge, and we state our reasons. Do you have any questions before we conclude the hearing?
Can I ask what would be required that I could better myself? What would you like to see so that you could say, hey, you know what, this guy's getting somewhere?
Sir, I would work with your CO3 on any programming that's available to you inside the prison system. We look at the totality of the case. Each time you come before the board, we conduct our interview with you, and we maintain our independence and deliberate as fairly as possible. But I would speak to your counselors or your CO3.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
This concludes our hearing. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.